So we're going to talk now about urothelial bladder cancer, a lot going on there as well, particularly a new approach to first-line therapy. Very curious to hear what the faculty has to say about that, many other issues. We have Sumi Vatigana from the Palm Beach, not too far from here, on the Florida Cancer Specialist. How are you doing today, Sumi? And Dr. Shilpa Gupta from the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, and Dr. Jonathan Rosenberg from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. We're going to start out talking about localized urothelial bladder cancer and then talk about metastatic disease. So why don't we start out with a little bit of data here, Shilpa, and talk about some of the new data sets that are coming out in non-metastatic disease.
Thank you, Dr. Love. Really honored to be here with Dr. Rosenberg here to discuss urothelial cancer. So there's a lot of unmet needs in the treatment of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer and muscle invasive bladder cancer. We know that about one-third of patients with NMIBC receive intravesical BCG, and close to 50% patients with MIBC may not even receive curative intent therapy. And despite curative intent cystectomy, a lot of patients recur and develop metastatic disease. So the field of NMIBC has really exploded over the last decade. In the past, as medical oncologists, we weren't even involved in this disease state. It was primarily a disease which urologists were managing, and now we are really integrated in the management of this disease because there's a lot of new therapies, including systemic immune therapies and a lot of intravesical therapies that require medical oncology input. So it's really exciting to see the field evolving for BCG unresponsive NMIBC with a variety of new drugs, which I'll discuss. So the first trial that provided efficacy for single agent pembrolizumab in BCG-unresponsive high-risk NMIBC was the KEYNOTE-057 cohort A, in which patients had carcinoma in situ with or without papillary disease, high-grade Ta or T1. And this is the initial data we first saw back in 2019, which showed encouraging activity if we look at the 12-month follow-up here. And this was approved by the FDA for treatment for patients with BCG-unresponsive high-risk NMIBC CIS plus minus papillary disease who were not candidates for cystectomy or refusing cystectomy. But as we saw longer follow-up, we saw that only 19% of patients remained in CR. So the efficacy of pembrolizumab really dropped over time, and it still remains a valid option. However, we do have better options with the higher response rates now, but this has been kind of now the new benchmark for a control arm. And we also saw the cohort B from KEYNOTE-057, where papillary high-risk NMIBC patients also benefited from pembrolizumab. This is now incorporated in the NCCN guidelines only in the U.S. This is an exciting BCG-naive trial for patients with BCG-naive high-risk NMIBC who were randomized to subcutaneous checkpoint inhibitor, ceselinumab, and BCG versus only BCG induction with the immunotherapy, and arm C is just BCG induction and maintenance as standard of care. And we saw the press release that it improved event-free survival in this patient population, and we have not seen the data yet, hopefully at some upcoming meeting. And these are other key phase three trials where systemic immunotherapy is being combined with BCG for BCG-naive patients, and we hope to see the data at some point. Moving on to this really novel drug delivery system called TAR-200, which really has transformed this field even more. This is looks like a pretzel, and it's an osmotic system with a sustained release of gemcitabine locally within the bladder. So there's been use of gemcitabine and docetaxel intravesically, but when we give gemcitabine through this method, it just has better efficacy, it seems. So SunRISe-1 is the trial where TAR-200 is being studied in BCG-unresponsive high-risk NMIBC. There's a variety of cohorts in this, and They're also combining it with sutrilimab, which is a checkpoint inhibitor. And we saw that cohort 2 data was really very promising if you look at the response rates in, you know, even in centrally assessed response rates were over 80%. And this drug has FDA breakthrough therapy designation. We hope to see this become available for our patients at some point. And this is, again, the new drug application initiated with the US FDA for this agent for high-risk NMIBC, which is BCG unresponsive. Then we have the phase 3 Sunrise 3 trial, which is BCG naive high-risk NMIBC patients. They're randomized to three groups, TAR-200 plus sutrilimab versus BCG induction and maintenance, and versus just TAR-200. We also have the Sunrise 5 trial, which is recurrent high-risk NMIBC after BCG treatment. Primary endpoint is disease-free survival. And here the group A is the TAR-200, and the group B is intravesical gemcitabine or intravesical mitomycin, which is currently the standard of care for BCG unresponsive patients, and patients are allowed to cross over to TAR-200. Now, this is a busy slide, not to do cross-trial comparison, but there's a lot of other intravesical therapies that have really shown promising data, and some are available for use in clinic, like nadofaragene and the N-803 with BCG, and others were reported from early trials. So the field is rapidly evolving, and we hope to see new developments soon. FGFR mutations, as we know, are frequently observed in bladder cancer, especially non-muscle invasive. They are seen at a higher frequency. And while systemic erdafitinib was found to be very toxic in patients with FGFR-altered tumors, the TAR-210 is, again, the same technology as TAR-200, but instead of gemcitabine, there's erdafitinib delivery system in this. And in the cohort 1 for patients with FGFR alterations, we saw some remarkable activity here. And again, in the cohort 3 high-risk NMIBC, intermediate-risk NMIBC also, there was pretty remarkable efficacy, as you can see, 100% at 6 months, 89% at 9 months. So the phase 3 trial is called the Moonrise. So all the TAR-210 studies are the Moonrise studies, which we'll continue to see data from. Switching gears to muscle-invasive bladder cancer, it has a high societal burden with the annual cost of bladder just in the U.S. for bladder cancer care is $5 billion for localized disease, still a high risk of recurrence despite curative surgery. We know that neoadjuvant cisplatin-based chemotherapy prior to cystectomy improves survival. We've seen this in large phase 3 trials. And long-term, there's an overall survival improvement of 8%. Adjuvant therapy ultimate goal is to improve disease-free survival and overall survival. To date, we don't have a randomized trial setting the standard for adjuvant chemotherapy, but meta-analysis have shown improvement in overall survival. Cisplatin-based chemotherapy, that is. And now we're fortunate to have three large trials completed in this space with adjuvant immunotherapy. The IMvigor010 studied adjuvant atezolizumab versus observation. This was a negative study for both DFS and OS. CheckMate 274 studied nivolumab versus placebo. It showed improvement in disease-free survival. Overall survival is trending towards improvement. And the Ambassador study, which led by Dr. Rosenberg and Dr. Paula from the cooperative group, looked at pembrolizumab and observation. We saw disease-free survival improvement, no OS improvement. So this was the negative IMvigor010 study, and the CheckMate 274, as we can see, improved disease-free survival, and we saw the three-year follow-up data recently, and that continues to improve disease-free survival, and OS is trending in the right direction. In Ambassador study, we saw the disease-free survival benefit compared to observation. There was no OS benefit reported. And interestingly, while in CheckMate 274, patients with PD-L1 positive tumors derived greater benefit, in the Ambassador study, we saw the exact opposite, that patients with PD-L1 positive tumors did not derive benefit. and those with negative tumors derive more benefit with pembrolizumab. Now, IMvigor010, even though it was a negative study, we learned that patients who had ctDNA positive status derived benefit, and now we have two large phase 3 trials looking at ctDNA positive patients being treated with immunotherapy. These are the ongoing perioperative trials, and Niagara is the only positive trial that has reported so far, where neoadjuvant GEMSYS was compared to GEMSYS durvalumab, followed by adjuvant durvalumab. This improved event-free survival and overall survival already presented at ESMO, and hope to see it approved in the near future. In conclusion, treatment for NMIBC and MIBC are rapidly evolving, and outcomes are being improved with immunotherapy and novel therapies. There's still an unmet need to identify valid biomarkers to select patients for the most appropriate treatment and allow bladder preservation. Thank you.
So in a second, Sumi, I'd like to hear about your 48-year-old man, but just getting back to the issue of non-muscle invasive disease, I'm curious whether these patients get to medical oncologists. You have patients in your practice, or are you treating any patients?
Yes, I do. I do see some even earlier patients like you're presenting, even with the intravesical BCGs, and I had a patient even with the vaccine, you know, they had some questions from the urologist, so I do see even those patients, and then non-muscle invasive and muscle invasive.
Jonathan, any thoughts about non-muscle invasive disease in terms of how you approach it outside a clinical trial nowadays?
You know, I think pembrolizumab is an option for those patients with refractory disease. I'm not convinced it's dramatically better than the natural history and does come with toxicity, but there clearly are some responders. I think, though, there is going to be an increasing role for immune checkpoint blockade, particularly with sasanlimab, depending on what that data looks like in untreated patients. I think the potential killer app, so to speak, in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer is going to be these intravesical prolonged delivery devices. I think, as Shilpa said, they're potentially highly active. And for a localized cancer, you don't need systemic toxicity.
Yeah, I mean, that's really an exciting and interesting technology as well. Jonathan, what about the adjuvant situation? Shilpa was talking about the difference between the three major trials. I'm curious what your thoughts are about how to explain it and whether you see ctDNA as sort of the way out.
Right. I think ctDNA is going to be very important, and IMvigor011 will help us understand that, which is the adjuvant atezo based on only treating ctDNA-positive patients. You know, the Ambassador trial, the OS, is unlikely to be positive but is still immature. Nivolumab, the adjuvant data suggests that there's a strong trend and may never turn positive. And so some of it is a question mark of, you know, can you salvage patients, so to speak, I hate that term, with immunotherapy and if they relapse, and do you need to treat early? This is going to be more of a moot point as time goes on, because I think everyone's going to be getting it in the neoadjuvant setting. But there are, of course, going to be some patients who don't get neoadjuvant therapy regardless, and in those patients, it's important. I think this data at the moment is strongest for nivolumab. It was a placebo-controlled trial as opposed to open-label trials, and so probably has the strength of the data at the moment.
Shilpa, I'm curious right now how you're approaching adjuvant therapy, and do you ever use ctDNA?
So we do offer adjuvant nivolumab to patients who are high risk and are not candidates for adjuvant cisplatin if they've not received it. I am looking at ctDNA, although not making it a factor to make decisions based on that, and we are looking forward to seeing the data from IMvigor011 and then go from there.
Jonathan, what about the patient who is not a candidate for because of comorbidities of cystectomy or refuses cystectomy? How are you approaching those patients?
Yeah, so they're very good patients for chemoradiotherapy, and it's a good option for many patients. I think, you know, there is the optimal candidate for chemoradiation, which is a small solitary tumor without hydronephrosis, without a lot of CIS. But there are many patients in our practice who can't have a cystectomy, and so you're doing chemoradiation because you don't have another choice. And in that situation, you can get good outcomes and you can cure some patients. But big, bulky tumors, T4 tumors, they don't tend to do as well.
Any trials going on in that setting right now is the immunotherapy? You know, we have lung cancer where you use post-chemoradiation durvalumab.
We're waiting for the results of a couple of trials for concurrent chemoradiation with immunotherapy, one with pembrolizumab, another with atezolizumab. And we'll see that, you know, it may be that the adjuvant portion is the important part, which may be difficult to tease out in the current trials. People are looking to see whether you can give some of these antibody drug conjugates in combination with radiation as a different way of giving chemotherapy during chemo radiation, so that'll be interesting. But right now, we're waiting for the results of the phase three trials with immune checkpoint drugs.
So one other question, Shilpa, we're going to hear in a second about Sumi's case, but in terms of neoadjuvant therapy, obviously we have some exciting results in the first-line metastatic setting with enfortumab, pembrolizumab. Can you talk about trials looking at that combination in the neoadjuvant setting? Is that something you'd ever do outside of a trial?
So two large trials have been completed. One is EV-Pembro in cisplatin-eligible patients, and one is the EV-Pembro in cisplatin-ineligible patients. So outside of trials, we are not really offering that right now, but I'm very hopeful that this regimen may move into the perioperative setting if we see the responses like we saw in the metastatic setting.
Jonathan, any thoughts about that? And also tolerability and how this is going to play out in the neoadjuvant setting?
You know, I think the concern that I've raised and others have raised is the adjuvant portion, maybe less so with the neoadjuvant portion. You know, the randomized phase three trials have been monitored by DSMBs, and they haven't been stopped for excessive toxicity, and so I'm encouraged by that. You know, we know that pathologic complete responses do predict very, very good outcomes, and do you need to, how much more benefit is there in adjuvant ADC therapy? And that's a question that the trials will not answer, because they're all sandwich approach trials with perioperative therapy. And so, you know, in my own experience, I find it somewhat easier to give EV-Pembro for most patients compared to cisplatin-based chemotherapy. But there are the occasional patients where it's quite toxic for to get EV-Pembro, and in that situation, you know, they're more the outlier than the standard.
Interesting. Okay, Sumi, let's hear about your 48-year-old man.
So this is a 48-year-old gentleman who has a history of hypertension. He's an avid alcohol user, an active smoker, just stopped prior to the diagnosis recently. He was initially came to our practice because of low platelets. That was his consultation. His platelets were about 106,000. Later, he presented with hematuria. That's what prompted the urologist to do a cystoscopy. This was actually in December, around Christmas time last year. And the cystoscopy showed a 5 centimeters right lateral wall of the bladder, and the biopsy was positive for high-grade TCC, a transition cell, and it was muscle-invasive. He had the TURBT and the installation of amicar, or the tranexamic acid, and had scans, CT scans, bone scans, which showed no evidence of metastatic disease. He does have a family history with mother had breast cancer, GBM, and father had renal cell CA. He's 48, so we did a genetic testing, which was negative. So that's when I saw him for neoadjuvant therapy and was deciding whether to do chemotherapy, and was aware of the Niagara trial. So my recommendation was to do chemoimmunotherapy. So I did apply for the CIS, GEM, and DURVA, but the insurance company, you know, I had to do a peer-to-peer. They said there's in the NCCN, there's no guidelines for this, so we're not approving it.
So
it's still in the process now. I did get a compassionate approval for the DURVA, so he's going to start soon because there's some financial things with how the chemo, was it approved or not. It was approved, but there was some back and forth with the insurance company.
So Jonathan, I'd like your thoughts about this, but Sumi, what was the explanation for the thrombocytopenia?
I think it's because of the alcohol. He was an avid user. He just stopped since the diagnosis. After the cystoscopy, he stopped smoking and drinking.
Interesting. So Jonathan, any thoughts about this case?
You know, I think it sounds like while the patient's younger, certainly many of our patients are comorbid with a lot of other health conditions. I think it's, you know, durvalumab currently does not have an FDA approval for bladder cancer. It was withdrawn voluntarily after the results of the metastatic trials. So now we're sort of in a waiting mode until, with some insurance companies approving it and others not, and not in all the guidelines adequately. So But I can't see that it would not get approved by the FDA based on the data.
Shilpa, any thoughts or recommendations about this case?
Yeah, I think, you know, if there's problems getting durvalumab, I would start GemCis as soon as possible, and then depending on what the patient has at cystectomy, offer adjuvant immunotherapy.
So a couple questions, like getting back to TAR-200. Curious, Jonathan, if TAR-200 becomes available, how do you see integrating it into your practice? Have you had patients already receiving this therapy, and how they tolerate it?
You know, we haven't had a lot, and the urologists have tended to manage most of them. I think, you know, certainly, you know, the data in muscle invasion was negative and the trial was stopped compared to chemo radiation. And so I think for the high-risk refractory BCG unresponsive disease, it's a very interesting idea. But it does require intravesical administration of the pretzel every 3 weeks. And so it means that patients are getting a cystoscopy or an insertion, a catheter every 3 weeks. So that is a consideration as opposed to, you know, 6 weeks in a row. That's probably better, but it's longer term.
And Shilpa, you were talking about the TAR-210 study looking at erdafitinib intravesically, which I found fascinating. Do you see systemic effects with that?
Not that we saw with that. And that was the beauty of the whole system, because systemic erdafitinib is really very toxic.
We're going to get into that in a second, but can you give us a little preview, Shilpa, in terms of the kinds of things you do see with erdafitinib?
For the systemic use of erdafitinib, the key side effects are hyperphosphatemia, which is a class effect, nail changes, skin changes, retinal detachment, serious ocular toxicities, just, you know, affects the quality of life a lot.
All right, well, let's talk about metastatic disease, Jonathan.
Great, thanks so much, and I appreciate the opportunity. These are my disclosures. So, first start with a slightly historical viewpoint, avelumab as a maintenance therapy for metastatic disease. This came about several years ago. In patients who respond or have stable disease to chemotherapy, randomized to either avelumab or best supportive care. And for patients who started on primary chemotherapy for metastatic disease, this is a very reasonable option, and showed that there is a sustained advantage to giving maintenance therapy after chemotherapy for metastatic cancer, both cis or carboplatin-based therapy. Both improved progression-free survival and overall survival for those patients. But these days, most patients are not necessarily receiving this approach. And more likely, they're receiving immune-based therapy at the outset from their treatment for metastatic disease. There were two trials embedded in CheckMate 901, testing the nivolumab plus gemcitabine cisplatin only versus gemcitabine cisplatin, or another trial, nivolumab and ipilimumab, compared to gem platinum. The doublet immunotherapy trial was negative. But the single agent plus chemotherapy with cisplatin alone is positive. And this was the study design in some more detail. Patients got 6 cycles of gemcis-nivo versus gemcis. And if they were on the nivo arm, they got maintenance nivolumab. And so this trial result was reported and showed a benefit for the addition of nivolumab to gemcitabine cisplatin, both for PFS and OS. With a hazard ratio of 0.78 for overall survival, as you see here on the top panel. A real, but I would say modest improvement in outcomes with the addition of chemotherapy in this setting, a more than doubling of the 24-month progression-free rate, but still, I would say, a modest improvement. The toxicities were additive and not necessarily synergistic in any way, and basically what you expect from chemotherapy with a few immune-related adverse events added on. The drug that really changed the field is enfortumab vedotin, which is a Nectin-4-directed antibody-drug conjugate. Nectin-4 is highly expressed in urothelial cancers, and it has been shown in previously treated patients who received prior immune checkpoint blockade and standard platinum-based chemotherapy that improved survival. And this is the third-line trial, or higher trial, of EV versus taxane chemotherapy or vinflunine if you're in Europe, showing a four-month improvement in median survival in a very refractory population where we hadn't seen improvement in outcomes, with a pretty robust response rate of over 40%. I would say these weren't transformative results, but the first time we really saw results in this multiply refractory patient population. Around the same time, enfortumab was combined with pembrolizumab, immune checkpoint drug, in untreated cisplatin-ineligible metastatic urothelial cancer. These are patients with renal insufficiency or cardiac disease or other comorbidities that make them not good cisplatin candidates, and showed that the response rate was in the 60s to low 70s. And in this confirmatory cohort, the response rate with EV and pembro was 64%. EV monotherapy did well, but not as well, 45% response rate, really showing that the combination there really is, there's there. And this was the first studies that demonstrated the real benefits of this. And this led to EV-302, which is the randomized phase 3 clinical trial, testing the combination of enfortumab and pembrolizumab compared to gemcitabine and platinum chemotherapy, either cis or carbo, randomized trial, 6 cycles of chemotherapy, versus up to 2 years of pembro and as much EV as the patient could tolerate and the doctor wanted to give, and had dual primary endpoints, both progression-free survival and overall survival. Patients were stratified by cisplatin eligibility and PD-L1 expression and the presence or absence of liver mets, which is a real negative prognostic feature if they're there. And these data led to, was presented at ESMO in 2023 to a standing ovation, a dramatic improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival, doubling both PFS and almost doubling OS, hazard ratio of less than 0.5, 0.45 for PFS, 0.47 for OS. Pretty transformative therapy for advanced urothelial cancer, going to be pretty hard to beat. The response rate, again, is in the 60s. Interestingly enough, enfortumab in every trial recapitulates the findings of the previous of the smaller trial quite accurately, interestingly enough. Now we're approaching median survivals of 2.5 years compared to under 2 years for patients who are treated with platinum-based approaches. The only significant criticism of this study is that many patients did not receive maintenance immunotherapy on the chemotherapy arm, although the trial was started and designed before avelumab was a standard of care, but later was amended to allow incorporation. So we see the confirmed response rate of 67%, including 29% of patients having complete responses, something we really haven't seen, whereas chemotherapy, a 32% partial response rate and 12% CR rate. And so this has been FDA approved like 6 weeks after the presentation. This was approved for all patients with metastatic urothelial cancer. Really swift change in the standard of care. The toxicity profile is different than chemotherapy. It's a mix of ADC and IO toxicities. We see here peripheral neuropathy, which is related to the cytotoxic, is a major issue, although most of the toxicities aren't severe, particularly with neuropathy. It can be bothersome and lead to treatment discontinuation. We also see skin toxicity, some diarrhea. Does not have the cytopenias you see in patients treated with chemotherapy. The median number of cycles was 12 with enfortumab and pembro, which is about 6 months or a little over 6 months. Interestingly, we saw some data more recently at GU Cancer Symposium and at ESMO looking at subgroups of patients and how they did. And one question has always been, do you need Nectin-4 expression for this to be an active combination? And we see that the benefit is maintained in terms of overall survival regardless of Nectin-4 expression level. It's actually interesting that Nectin-4 high patients have a worse prognosis regardless of treatment. But that the hazard ratio is quite similar if they're high or low, 0.42 versus 0.51. And so it really, Nectin-4 staining does not appear to matter in this patient population. And we're starting to see some of the very long-term data for EV and pembro from the first trial that was done, enfortumab pembro in patients who are cisplatin ineligible at 5 years. We see progression-free survival, duration of response, and overall survival are quite impressive. With PFS maintained essentially no events after 3 years, and the same thing with duration of response. And based on this trial, again, only a very small number of patients, about 40% of patients were alive at 5 years. And the median survival for these patients used to be 9 months. And so quite dramatic improvement. And we started to see some evidence of this in the follow-up data from EV-302 presented by Tom Powles just a few weeks ago, showing that there is a sustained improvement and we're getting out to landmarks. We're starting to see maybe a flattening of the curve with EV-Pembro for patients treated with probably a 15 to 25% higher survival absolute as time goes on. And so very excited to see the long-term data. Moving on from...
Just a quick question. Just kind of curious, you know, this EV-Pembro is kind of the poster child for antibody drug conjugate plus IO, which is being studied in many different solid tumors. Any thoughts about what's going on and the potential, the synergy that seems to be happening?
So there's two parts. It's clearly there's an additive component, right? I mean that, you know, you have two active drugs that are being used together. There is emerging data that suggests that MMAE in particular causes immunogenic cell death that leads to better presentation of antigen and activation of the immune response in the presence of pembrolizumab. And so I suspect that that's where the durability is coming from many of these patients, that you're getting enhanced immune activity. But that is not, that's maybe more than speculation, but not proven.
And Shilpa, any sort of clinical pearls about managing patients on EV-Pembro, particularly the EV in terms of tolerability issues that come up?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like Jonathan said, the toxicities are different and we really need to do a good physical and a history taking each time because patients may underreport their symptoms of neuropathy. And the neuropathy with EV can be very disabling if we continue to treat through it. So at the first chance of occurrence of neuropathy, we should hold EV and not resume it unless the neuropathy gets better to grade 1 or lower. And in our experience, you know, even when you hold the drug, patients do continue to derive benefit, like the median number of cycles was 9. And then the second big toxicity is the rash, so it's very important to do a skin exam each time the patient is coming for treatment and to use all the treatments, you know, topical steroids, systemic steroids, as the case may be. And keep in mind that it could be from Pembro too, but the rash from EV does look different, and we first hold EV, see if it gets better or not, and then we go from there.
Anything you want to add to that, Jonathan?
Yeah, I think it's important to see patients at their treatment visits, early, especially early on in the treatment, because that's when the serious skin rashes can occur. And so it's given day 1, day 8. It's important to have that day 8 visits. I see them cycle 2, day 1, because that's the time that you could get into the more serious toxicities. And those tend to be the EV rashes. The Pembro rashes often occur a bit later. Maybe less concerning. Everyone knows how to manage checkpoint inhibitor rash. But if you don't intercept a rash, you can end up getting into really difficult circumstances with blistering and other more serious things like Steven Johnson or TEN. They're very rare, but you certainly don't want to run into that situation if you can avoid it.
All right, erdafitinib.
So erdafitinib is FGFR3, actually a pan-FGFR inhibitor. That is approved for advanced urothelial cancer with FGFR mutations, 2 and 3 mutations, FGFR2 and FGFR3, although FGFR2 mutations are vanishingly rare. And it was studied in 2 phase 3 trials that were parallel. One is in patients who received prior checkpoint, which was cohort 1, and cohort 2 was patients who hadn't received a prior checkpoint, and randomized against pembrolizumab. The first trial, they're randomized against taxane chemotherapy. The primary endpoint was overall survival. And the two studies read out. Cohort 1, erdafitinib did improve survival compared to taxane or vinflunine in these IO-experienced patients. And in cohort 2, compared to pembrolizumab, it did not improve survival. And we saw that at the end of the day, pembrolizumab looked just as good, if not a little better. For patients who are post-EV-Pembro, post-platinum, post-immunotherapy, erdafitinib does have improved outcomes, but the toxicity profile is not trivial. It's not necessarily dangerous toxicities, but it's quality of life effects on the patient. with mucositis, dry mouth, dysgeusia, skin and nail toxicity. The skin toxicity is usually manageable. The nail toxicity causes a lot of onycholysis. And then there is ocular toxicity, as Dr. Gupta had mentioned, and so it does require ophthalmologic monitoring. Hyperphosphatemia occurs and is an on-target toxicity with FGFR1 inhibition. There is a dose titration to go up from 8 to 9 milligrams if you don't have some, if your phosphate level hasn't gone up. I think it is not that tolerable, but still you can do that to go up to the higher dose. And it is the first targeted therapy for a TKI approved for advanced bladder cancer. There are some interesting drugs that are being tested in investigational contexts. This is initial results of two FGFR3 selective inhibitors. You know, medicinal chemistry has gotten really good and can deal with the subtle differences between FGFR1, 2, and 3 binding pockets. And so LOXO-435 and TARA-300 are both FGFR3 selective TKIs. On the left, you see the waterfall plot from LOXO-435 presented by my colleague Gopa Iyer just a couple of weeks ago. At doses at 200 milligrams or above, they left out the low-dose patients. And on the right, you see the results from TYRA-300, which includes a broader patient population treated in their trial, including the lower doses, primarily on the left. And we are starting to see really good activity, and interestingly, much less of the mucocutaneous toxicities, although you do still see some diarrhea. And so I'm very excited to see where these drugs go, whether they have a role in early disease versus later disease in combination with other therapies. Very exciting times for that.
Before you get into that, just before we get off of erdafitinib, first of all, Sumi, I'm curious, have you given erdafitinib?
No, I haven't. Not for bladder. I have given for biliary tract cancer.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, how often we talk about stuff, and then I talk to a general oncologist and say they've never seen it. So then when you do see it, you know, you got to deal with the issues. We were talking about this yesterday with a biliary session. Getting back to the phosphate, Shilpa, like, what about diet and any other sort of clues about using this drug?
Yeah, we do counsel our patients on, you know, diet, which is low in phosphate. And key is to check their labs every week and check in with these patients. Just because it's an oral therapy doesn't mean we don't need to see them as often as we do IV. In fact, I think we need to see them more with their lab work.
All right, HER2. It seems like we talk about this the whole weekend.
Yes, well, you know, it helps when you have a pan solid tumor approval for amplified tumors. So HER2 alterations are actually a real thing in bladder cancer. It's one of the most altered tumors, primarily mutations and less so amplifications, and some patients have both mutation and amplification. Up to about 25% have high-level overexpression, and maybe even up to 50% have some expression of HER2, depending on the series you look at. And so it's a very interesting therapeutic target. This is the data from DESTINY-PanTumor02 in the bladder cohort, showing that overall the response rate was 39 patients, and if you had HER2 3+, it was over 50%, and still respectable if you were 2+, at 35%. And the time to event outcomes that have been reported look very similar for PFS and OS, regardless of IHC status, interestingly enough. And so 7 months PFS, roughly, and 13 months overall survival. Again, these tend to be refractory patients who progressed on immunotherapy and other prior cytotoxic approaches. So this is an option for patients with 3+ outside of a trial. We do use it. You have to watch the usual trastuzumab deruxtecan toxicities, particularly pneumonitis.
Where you go on, let's keep on that for a second. Because Albina here has a patient with an ERBB2 mutation, but the HER2 is 1+. What do we know about HER2, the TDXD? I know this has been looked at outside of breast cancer, lung cancer, really, because that's where it's used most.
So the mutation spectrum in lung cancer is different than in bladder cancer. And so I'm not sure that it depends on the mutation. If it's one of the lung cancer mutations that leads to internalization, then maybe it's a great option for the patient. But if it's not, the mutation itself may not sensitize. There are studies going on for HER2 low with mutations. I don't remember if we've seen results for that, but certainly It's interesting. There may be other better approaches, and there are some trials for TKIs targeting HER2 that are sort of third generation, not just tucatinib, but things that are newer that might be better options.
And I'm curious, you know, I know it's very anecdotal, but to me, this is the way I started hearing about HER2 low in breast cancer, when I started hearing about cases where people had clearly had great responses. Have you seen any good responses to T-DXd in bladder cancer?
I have. I mean, I had one patient on the DESTINY trial that was on for 2.5 years really did incredibly well. I've had others that have gotten 9-12 months out of it so far. I think there's other ADCs that are targeting HER2 that are also very interesting in bladder cancer. One of them, which is on my next slide, is disitamab vedotin, which is an MMAE-based ADC, which makes it a little difficult to give after enfortumab, and maybe it's a treatment for selected populations as frontline therapy. But similarly active to EV in HER2-high patients.
If you had a patient who had run out of options and was HER2-1 or 2+, if you could, would you try T-DXd?
If I could get it, I would try it, particularly 2+. I think what we're seeing, though, with at least disitamab vedotin, where this has been explored a little more, not in the U.S., but in China, that there's a lot of activity of that agent in HER2-1 and 2+.
Also, getting back to the practical issues, again, we talked about this in breast cancer, but I'm always curious to compare outside of breast cancer, where you all have less experience with T-DXd. In breast cancer, they're very aggressive about anti-emesis. They use delayed olanzapine in some cases. I'm curious what you've seen in bladder cancer. Also, in breast cancer, very aggressive about looking for ILD. They get scans every 9 weeks if they can, in addition to clinical assessment. What about bladder cancer?
We're not getting scans. We're getting scans every 9 weeks because it's an aggressive cancer. So we're looking to see response. I've started using more antiemetic prophylaxis simply because our breast colleagues do, but I haven't noticed that it's been different, to be honest.
All right, let's talk about some other HER2 agents.
Yeah, so there's a variety of ADCs that are interesting targets in urothelial cancer. So HER2, as I said, the second bullet point, disitamab vedotin, has high activity in untreated patients and in platinum and IO refractory patients, and appears to synergize with checkpoint inhibition. But in a world where enfortumab vedotin has been given to everyone, where how it's going to play out is unclear to me. Nectin-4 may not go away with resistance. Patients often have neuropathy that precludes further therapy. And so there are several ADCs that are being looked at with other payloads, topoisomerase payloads. And there are also radiopharmaceuticals that are starting to be getting into the market to test targeting Nectin-4. And then TROP2 remains a valid and viable target in urothelial cancer. While the phase 3 TROPiCS-04 sacituzumab trial was negative for sacituzumab govitecan in advanced urothelial cancer due to toxicity, sacituzumab tirumtecan and datopotamab deruxtecan are both being investigated and have activity, and we'll see more from them in the future. One drug that was reported at ESMO that I was had the opportunity to comment on was this bispecific ADC targeting EGFR and HER3, which has a pretty high level of anti-tumor activity in advanced urothelial patients treated on this trial, and so we're very these are refractory patients, again, done in China, but we'll see what it's like as it hits us in clinical trials, and there may be larger trials testing this coming up very soon.
So we're going to hear about a case of from Sumi of a 63-year-old woman, but a couple more questions from the audience. Shilpa Haritha wants to know, how do you think through neoadjuvant treatment in patients who are non-cis eligible?
Currently, for patients who are not eligible for cisplatin, upfront cystectomy is the standard of care. Or if you know they want to go for bladder preservation, then we can do chemoradiation with gemcitabine-based therapies. But I think once we get the data from the EV Pembro in this space, that would probably be the most effective option, hopefully.
So let's hear about your 63-year-old woman. I would point out, Jonathan, you know, I guess we have three positive phase three trials in the first-line metastatic setting, thinking back to the avelumab maintenance, now the Nevo study. So in shifting to enfortumab vedotin, that is an indirect comparison, although it's kind of obvious why this decision was made. But I'm curious, in light of that, what your thoughts are about this patient, this 63-year-old woman. What happened?
Yeah, so this is a 63-year-old woman who is from Bangladesh. She's here with her daughter. You know, she takes care of the kids. She has diabetes mellitus. She was diagnosed with a stage 4 urothelial carcinoma of the bladder. This was in August of 2021. I was not taking care of her. She was with a different oncologist a little further away from where I practice. And at that time, she had hydronephrosis. There was involvement of the retroperitoneal lymph nodes. There was some thoracic adenopathy, supraclavicular adenopathy. She did have a nephrostomy tube placed because of the hydronephrosis, and she had resection of the bladder tumor by cystoscopy. And she was started on chemotherapy with carboplatin and Gemzar. This was followed by avelumab maintenance, and after, from what the records I have, is they said she couldn't tolerate it because of presumed adrenal insufficiency. So she just continued on chemotherapy with carbo and Gemzar for almost 8 months. There was a good significant response, so she was continued on chemo. And then in about 5 months later, she had some disease progression, and when there was no evidence of disease with good response, the chemo was stopped because she was having some toxicity with all the cytopenias. She couldn't tolerate it. She was driving long distance, so they gave her a break. And then they did the scans. There was some progression of disease, so they just started on single-agent Gemzar. So when she came to me, she was on single-agent Gemzar, and she had some scans done, a PET scan, which showed, again, adenopathy. She was having more pain. She had significant pain. She was on a fentanyl patch. She was on Percocet. I mean, she had a nephrostomy tube still, which was there. Her kidneys function was normal. So when I saw her, I mean, she was in, so, and they were considering even hospice. So her daughter lives close to our office, so she decided to see us. We were like 2 blocks away from where she lives. And she was wondering why she was going all the way about 40 miles to see an oncologist. So when I saw her, I saw that there was no clear discussion about what was the adrenal insufficiency. She was fine. She had a good performance status except for the pain. So I decided to do the Pembro and the EV, and I got the approval, and she has been on it for since almost, I would say, about 6 months now. And she has a significant response. All her pain is gone. She's not taking any pain medications. And she continues on therapy. She has no side effects. She's doing really well.
Really amazing case. Jonathan, any thoughts? You know, we were talking yesterday about, isn't oncology depressing? And you hear a story like this, and you know, think about how rewarding it can be sometimes.
You know, I think this is a situation where you have, you know, really highly active treatments that entered into the practice, you know, after she had been treated initially. So what they did at the time was very reasonable. But there's a better option now for the patients. It's not, you know, I'm glad she got the combination. And, you know, it makes a lot of sense in this scenario.
It sounds like she didn't really have an adequate course of avelumab. If she had, do you ever use IO after IO? Would you use ipi-nivo after a single agent?
You know, that's the toughest question we have right now in this setting. There's no data to tell us one way or the other, except in some other cancers, which suggests that it doesn't really help. And so I've done it, but I can't say I think it is much better than doing single-agent EV in that scenario.
So we're going to move on and take a break. Thank you so much.